Good evening. Thank you all for coming. Special welcome to those of you who are new or relatively new to the Zendo. My name is Shinryu. I'm one of the teachers here. And normally once a month we have a Fusatsu ceremony and an atonement ceremony, and we didn't do that this month. We actually missed it. But I thought I would speak tonight on some issues that have to do with Fusatsu. First of all, recognizing the karmic suffering in our midst and recognizing our responsibility for that suffering. The great Japanese poet Isa, who lived in the late 18th, early 19th century, wrote a haiku that goes like this. A world of dew, and within every dewdrop, a world of struggle. For Isa, this wasn't just an abstract idea. He knew what he was talking about. He had a difficult life. He was from a peasant family in the countryside in Japan. He lost his mother when he was 3 years old. He had a difficult family situation after that. He was raised by his grandmother, but his grandmother died when he was 14. His father remarried when he was 8, and he never got along with the stepmother. And he was sent away at a young age to fend for himself. He married, and then his firstborn child died shortly after he was born. Then a daughter died as an infant. A third child died. His wife died. His house burned down, and he had to take shelter in a storage building. And he wrote another poem that says, "The fleas have fled from the burning house and have taken refuge with me here." So every life, as ephemeral and as delicate as a drop of dew, is filled with anguish like this. And in every life, there is this kind of struggle. Especially because we fail to appreciate the beauty of our lives. Just as a dewdrop is not aware of the light from the morning sun that it itself reflects. Isa had the sensitivity, not only of someone who lived a hard life, but the sensitivity of a poet. And he was able to see his own intimacy with the fleas in the midst of his own homelessness. We are studying a book of Zen koans, Zen stories about women ancestors. And the one that I wanted to share with you tonight is called Ling's Question. It's from China, probably around the 9th century. And it goes like this. Ling Jingpo visited Master Fu Bei Heishang to pay her respects. They sat together and drank tea, and she asked him, "If a true word can't be spoken, no matter how hard you try, how will you teach?" And Fu Bei said, "Fu Bei has nothing to say." Ling was not satisfied. She placed her hands inside the opposite sleeves of her robe and cried out, "There is grievous suffering, even within a blue sky." Again, Fu Bei had nothing to say. And Ling said, "To be human is to live in calamity." So, Ling was not satisfied with Fu Bei. Fubei had nothing to say. She, however, did have something to say. And so she spoke up about it, and she challenged the master very forcefully. I was thinking about this story in relation to another book. There's a Japanese teacher who taught in this country, Katagiri Roshi. And his second book was entitled, You Have to Say Something. So Katagiri taught, you have to say something. You have to do something. I'll tell you a part of his teaching in this book, You Have to Say Something. He tells the story about this monk who asked a master, what is the essence of Buddhism? And the master said, step forward from the top of a 100-foot pole. What is the essence of Buddhism? Step forward from the top of a 100-foot pole. And then Katagiri talks about how as our practice deepens through Zazen, through meditation, we learn to return to silence. In Katagiri's first book, it was called Returning to Silence. First book is Returning to Silence. The second book is You Have to Say Something. So he says, after our practice deepens like this, we ask, what is this silence? How can I speak of it? Do I just keep my mouth shut? No, I don't think so. Even if you don't say anything, there's still a problem. Silence, Buddha nature, is not something apart from your life. It compels you to speak. That is why the Zen master had to speak. He had to say something. He had to speak from that silence, from Buddha nature. And Katagiri goes on, when you really understand your life, when you really understand what makes it possible for all beings to exist, there is nothing to say. You just keep silent. But you still have to do something. This is why I always tell you to keep your mouth shut and act with a true heart. Buddha nature is the state of your life as you stand atop a 100-foot pole. You have to do something. Take one step. So I think this also gets at Ling's teaching in this story about Ling and Fubei. So Ling knows that the sky is blue, and yet she still takes a step forward and she cries out. There's grievous suffering, she cries out. And I think that this was actually Ling keeping her mouth shut and acting with a true heart. A little while ago, a few weeks ago maybe, Nyogetsu, a member of our Sangha, sent around a clip from the BBC. I don't know if you saw it. It was this Jamaican novelist named Marlon James who did kind of a plug for people to get more involved in struggles for social justice and environmental justice in our time. Did some of you see that? Okay. It's in your inbox somewhere if you look up Nyogetsu and Marlon James. I really recommend it. It's short. It's just a couple minutes. But the question he brings up is, are you a non-racist or an anti-racist? So maybe you can say that you're a non-racist, but can you say that you're an anti-racist? He says, I don't, I won't, I'm not, I'm never, I can't. That's the great thing about non. You can pull it off by simply rolling over in your bed and going to sleep. Do you get that? To be non is to be able to roll over in bed and go back to sleep. To be anti might be to throw off the covers and get up. So again, I think this speaks to Ling's, what Ling does in this story. She's unsatisfied with Fubei's passivity, his quietism. Fubei has nothing to say. That would be non. But Marlon James says, stop being non and start being anti. So you might object to this, that being anti doesn't sound too good. It sounds really negative. It sounds reactive. But actually, I think that the anti-stance, could be seen in a way as an essential component of Zen ethics. The first of the three pure precepts in Zen is to cease from evil. Now, in the Zen peacemaker order, the teaching of which we've inherited from Enkyo Roshi, often translates the first pure precept as the first pure precept is ceasing from evil, and the Zen peacemaker order gives that a contemporary spin by calling it not knowing, and thereby giving up fixed ideas about myself and the universe, not knowing. And I think this way of looking at the first pure precept is really wonderful. It's very deep, and it's potentially very helpful. But I think we also have to be careful about not getting stuck with the idea of not knowing. And certainly not to take not knowing as the equivalent of burying your head in the sand. And if you know a little about U.S. history, there was actually a political party that was the Know Nothing Party. And it was a group of mostly white Protestants who were very fearful about immigrants and religious others, in this case, Catholics. And they saw immigrants and these non-Protestants as a threat because they were going to take away jobs and because they would not be loyal to the nation because of their religious faith. Does it sound familiar? So I'm just offering this as another way to think about the first pure precept. Ceasing from evil, in a way, is being anti, in the way Marlon James is talking about. Don't be a non-racist, be an anti-racist. So Ling says, there is grievous suffering. And I think everyone in this room knows what she's talking about. Our moods swing from the morning to the evening. Sickness, old age, and death that happens for a multitude of reasons. They all surround us all the time. The losses keep mounting up, even in a single day. I looked at the newspaper today, and the front page had a story about the battle with schizophrenia, a story about the physical and psychic wounds of veterans from the military, as well as people who profit off of the suffering and wounds of veterans, a story about Nazi war criminals, the Zika virus in Brazil, the standoff between law enforcement and right-wing protesters who are trying to take over public lands, feuding between the modern know-nothing leader Donald Trump and the know-nothing media corporation, the Fox News. And in the tranquility of my home, I could hear the sirens and the horns out on the street. And when I went out on the street, I would see ambulances and flashing lights. In the 1930s, in a time of rising fascism, Stalinist repression, and the buildup towards World War II, the great Trinidadian historian C.L.R. James said, "Tranquility today is either innate, the Philistine, or to be acquired only by a deliberate doping of the personality." Tranquility today is either innate, the Philistine. Can you think of any Philistines? I think he meant someone who was intellectually disengaged from the news and debates about what's going on in the world. But they're actually political leaders who deliberately create and foment, and corporations that foment that kind of Philistinism. So tranquility today is either innate, the Philistine, or to be acquired only by a deliberate doping of the personality. And there are lots of ways of doping ourselves in this day and age, right? I'm just going to bring up one here, one way of doping ourselves, because it's relevant for us. I remember I saw a sort of a promotional piece. It was for a program of catalyzing conscious capitalism. And the slogan that it used was, "Shift your mind and the planet will follow." Shift your mind and the planet will follow. And I think that this kind of New Age fantasy is just one of many different sorts of spiritual promises that are out there in the marketplace today, but which really just serve to perpetuate our egocentric views of the world. Shift your mind and the planet will follow. Master Dogen, our great Zen teacher, said, "To carry the self forward and realize all things is illusion." To carry the self forward and realize all things is illusion. Shift your mind and the planet will follow. But religions have always tried to recruit followers with tales of paradise and these kinds of fixes. For example, promising that our little selves will survive after death. The poet Robinson Jeffers called this peopling the darkness beyond the stars with harps and habitations. And Buddhism does it too, with the promise of eternal bliss, of nirvana. That too could be a kind of doping of the personality. But in this story, Ling provides the antidote, the antidote to the dopiness and the denial of Fubei. And how does she do that? She cries out. There's grievous suffering. A poem from Robinson Jeffers. "This country least, but every inhabited country, is clotted with human anguish. Remember that at your feasts. And this is no new thing, but from time out of mind. No transient thing, but exactly coterminous with human life. Praise life, it deserves praise. But the praise of life that forgets the pain is a pebble rattled in a dry gourd." So Ling says, to be human is to live in a calamity. The problem is that when we open ourselves up and recognize the calamity, it can very quickly become overwhelming. And I think that's why we turn over in bed. Or we turn the page of the newspaper rather than really recognize it, engage with it, respond to it. And we all do this. Everyone here does it. Again and again, we fail to recognize it. We fail to respond to it. The grievous suffering is just too great. So what can we do? How can we respond without turning away? There's an interesting guy named Shigeto Oshida, who was brought up in a Zen Buddhist family, and he later became a Dominican friar. But there was always a Zen flavor to his teachings, and he said, we must stand up without disappearing in this sea of tears. We must stand up without disappearing in this sea of tears. So how can we do this? If we recognize the state of calamity, perhaps we need to say something. Like Ling, who spoke up and cried out when she met Fubei. So, what might we have to speak up about or cry out about in our own lives? Or perhaps we can respond through writing the way Issa did, or Robinson Jeffers, or Marlon James. Or like those members of our community who are in the correspondence program with prisoners in solitary confinement. Perhaps it's to stand up and do something. And what can we do? What would be appropriate to do given who we are and what our life is like? Not some unreal fantasy, heroic Savior kind of thing. Something appropriate to us. I think there are always infinite ways to respond. But I think our Zen practice is one good place to start. And for that we have the three pure precepts. The first of the three pure precepts is ceasing from evil or stopping harm. Don't be non, be anti. Or give up fixed ideas about ourselves and the world. And the second pure precept is doing good. We have to really attend to our own lives with wisdom and compassion. I think a way of doing good might be also to come to our monthly Fusatsu ceremony and acknowledge and atone for all the harmful actions that we're a part of as individuals and as members of the society. We can do good by bearing witness to the joy and suffering in the world. And the third pure precept is doing good for others. So it can be just taking a step to support someone you know who could use a little help, even a modest step. Or it could be taking action that contributes to an organization which is trying to make a difference by promoting justice or equality or whatever the values are that you believe in. When his daughter died at the age of 2.5 years, Issa wrote another poem. This dewdrop world is a dewdrop world. And yet. It is a dewdrop world in which all things quickly pass. And yet, we still mourn our losses. And the sky overhead may be blue, and yet we still struggle. We still need to stand up. We still need to organize. Thank you.